From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we have a conversation with Danny Haifong, the journalist and activist who now resides in the New York City area. We spoke with him via Skype from New York on Thursday. Dan, a pleasure. It's been way too long. And we're going to go through this whole phenomenology of quote-unquote resistance. I don't know, you should put maybe register trademark after resistance. with these various, you know, I don't know. They used to be called AstroTurf. This is maybe more of a hybrid grass, but that you know, has all these the mass media involved in organizing and Democratic Party involved in organizing. A lot of people that normally are grassroots organizers also involved in organizing. And then, of course, wall-to-wall media sympathetic coverage.
Right, and this was most recently seen in the March for Our Lives that happened a few weeks ago in March, where you know, hundreds of thousands of people across the country came out to protest quote-unquote gun violence and got behind the idea of gun control, which is not a new issue at all. It's something really that has been talked about almost ad nauseum every time a quote-unquote mass shooting happens inside of the United States involving a white perpetrator, usually from the suburbs, ends up shooting up a school, that sort of thing. It's been happening a lot more in recent years, despite the fact that gun violence as a whole has actually gone down in the United States. But what makes this march in particular even more significant is the fact that it comes in the era of Trump, where the ascendancy of the Trump administration has also precipitated a rebellion of billionaires, where the billionaire, or at least the servicemen of billionaires that a significant section of the ruling class wanted in Hillary Clinton did not take office, and Donald Trump ended up filling a vacuum that the ruling class could not fill. So here we are, where billionaires like Michael Bloomberg, Eli Broad, Warren Buffett have coalesced around this issue of gun control in order to try to take back the congressional seats in the midterm elections coming up, all on behalf of the Democrats. What's ended up happening, though, is that this issue has become a mass issue, one that people have taken very strong stances for and against, and it's really distracted from the real question of gun violence, the fact that the U.S. government sells the most weapons around the world to violent dictatorial regimes of Israel, Qatar, Saudi Arabia.
And itself, by the way.
In itself, it buys weapons from Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed Martin in order to rain terror over the people of Syria and people all over the world, right. The Middle East, Africa, you name it, all seven continents. So, you know, we have this issue of gun control and gun violence being completely narrowed down in order to serve one section of the billionaire ruling class, while things like the rampant lynchings of black people at the hands of the police continue unabated. Yesterday, a black person in Crown Heights here in New York City was murdered by the police, and that was preceded by the murder of Stephon Clark in Sacramento earlier in March. So, yeah, this whole question of gun violence and the March for Our Lives never mentions these facts, because if you look at the advisory board of Everytown USA, you see people like Warren Buffett, you see people like Michael Bloomberg, but also you see an assortment of former Navy personnel, former police chief personnel. So really what's happened is that a certain section of the billionaires has coalesced around this issue in order to try to take back Democratic Party control over the House and the Senate. So
even establishment control. I mean, You know, yeah. It's interesting to note that, and this is something that's not really part of the discussion yet, but at least that I, you know, that I've been paying attention to. But you've got what were the wedge issues in the 80s and 90s? You had abortion and gun control became the focal points of difference and distinction between the Democrats and Republicans. And consequently, there was a unanimity of policy on everything else, on the war and peace. You know, both parties would support whatever war was happening. On you know, questions of you know, withdrawing public services, privatization. You know, all of these things that we've suffered continuously now for the last 30 some odd years. There was instead placed dead center abortion and gun control as the wedge issues. And then we saw the phenomenon, you know, it started stirring with the crash in 2008, but then the 2016 election in particular, the phenomenon that lifted both Trump and Sanders, that was sort of a rejection of all of that and a focus on economic issues at front and center, and issues of war and peace, by the way, with respect to Trump, which was an unusual thing. But in other words, suddenly there were people voting in the Republican Party primaries, for example, said, well, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio were pointing at Trump and saying he's not sufficiently anti-abortion. The Republican core that had been voting on that issue for a couple of decades was saying, the hell with abortion, that guy said he's going to get me a job. And that happened, you know, a lot across the electoral landscape. And also, there was this rejection generally of the institutional framework for electoral politics that had preceded, which again centered on, to distill it, abortion and gun control. And now, as they attempt to manage this uprising that we saw, that this is the thing that they're bringing to, you know, front and center now is gun control, and I bet you see abortion end up there again too.
Right. What ends up happening in these questions is that a class analysis is completely erased and left out of the conversation. I think what the 2016 elections really showed us is that the material questions affecting working class people, affecting poor people, affecting Black people, affecting undocumented immigrants really came to the fore in a way that hasn't been able to happen or wasn't able to happen, especially under the era of Obama. And I think the coalescing of the ruling class around these particular issues is really an attempt to try to suppress the genuine material demands that people have that were building up prior to the 2016 elections with the advent of the Occupy Wall Street movement, right, the Black Lives Matter movement. Yep. These developments really show that at least on the domestic front, there was a stirring among the people, especially younger people who really ended up, especially younger Black voters, who really ended up taking it to the Democratic Party by staying out of the election. No one talks about that.
That's right.
So what we've seen is this desperation among the ruling class to try to reconfigure itself and realign the imperialist system in the way that it wants. So that's why we have gun control and gun violence on the one hand, giving some respite to the rancorous and completely loud and cacophonous calls for war with Russia, which is right now the real unifying point that everyone on the ruling class, except ironically, maybe a few people in the Trump camp, have been pushing since Trump won. And this is because partly war with Russia is a big policy point and a big plan among the ruling class, and it has been for years. It's on the agenda, but also the material questions that people in the United States and most people around the world who are living, you know, on less than $10 a day, billions of them, really want are off the table. Bruce Dixon had a really good article in Black Agenda Report last week talking about why gun violence has been so narrowed, and that's because things like single-payer healthcare, peace, around the world, demilitarization of the police, demilitarization of the military. All of these things are off of the table because the imperialism is going in one direction, the ruling class is going in one direction, and more people are becoming aware of this.
Yeah. It's they're trying to put the genie back in the bottle to a degree, and you saw the potential for this kind of uprising being barely latent. The WTO protests, in the late 90s, but particularly like the almost immediate mobilization against the war in Iraq in February and March of 2003. Millions and millions of people around the world, like, bam, like that. And then the same thing that happened with Occupy Wall Street. It was like when someone lit a match, across the world.
Exactly.
And so a lot of that got tamped down during the Obama administration for a variety of reasons. The material world has a tendency of bringing reality back to people, regardless of whatever consciousness they try to, fit onto their head. And the situation has become, over a period of decades, more and more desperate for more and more people. And I think that we kind of passed a turning point sometime in 2014, early 2015, where it started to show up in the electoral process, we saw it in the streets. First of all, one final shooting was just too much, and people exploded in cities across the United States with Black Lives Matter and all other manifestations of that phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to see both that came into the electoral process, and Hillary Clinton tried to manage it and failed. And then you also had this other phenomenon again, Trump and Sanders, that everybody's shaking their head saying, what? Mm-hmm. Sanders wasn't supposed to have a chance, and Trump was supposed to be more of a vanity run than anything, and now he's president.
Exactly, and the ruling class had to, that coalesced around Hillary Clinton, had to steal it from Sanders. They had to steal the victory from him.
They did.
Which makes it so disappointing when leftists, people who identify on the left in the United States, become so defensive about criticisms regarding things like March for Our Lives. I mean, you see the corporate media elevate so-called surviving youth of the shooting that happened in Parkland.
Right.
And, of course, young people shouldn't be denigrated. However, if we look at this from a class analysis perspective, if we understand that young people their age are unlikely to have the resources to develop a movement of such a caliber to mobilize forces, to have the resources available that can produce something like the hundreds of thousands of people that came out during the March for Our Lives event, then we know that there's obviously something else behind it. Us Marxian thinkers and activists understand that being determines consciousness.
Right.
And if we understand that the current conditions where a nonprofit like Everytown Against Gun Violence is funded by billionaires and other spooks, as well as the national security apparatus,
right,
then we know that they have a heavy hand in determining where exactly the ideology of that mobilization is going to go. And it's most likely going to go into efforts to stabilize and maintain the system of imperialism. And so if we're criticizing the fact that these relatively wealthy youth are not mentioning things like Black Lives Matter or endless war abroad, the police violence against Black people here in the United States, we do that because that's really the source of gun violence, and that's really and those are really issues that determine the struggle on a class basis that affect poor black people here in the United States, working class black people, and that affect workers all around the world. And that's where we need to be focusing our attention, because at the end of the day, whatever hapless, and it really never happens, it's probably not going to, whatever hapless legislation is produced out of these so-called spontaneous uprisings managed and controlled by the billionaire ruling class, happens to produce, where are we then?
Yeah,
where
are we then with
more background checks, with stigmatizing mentally ill people? Where are we? We're at square one. We have no analysis of the society that we live in, and we have, or the system that we live under, and we are, we are still under the whims of whatever the bourgeoisie, the ruling class, and its military state apparatus wants.
Right. Yeah, I mean, whatever comes out is at best mischievous, you know. There comes some kind of a legislation that does nothing but, you know, make people fill out some more forms, or, you know, make it difficult for this person or that person to, you know, go to the beauty parlor on Tuesday or something that has nothing to do with...
Or maybe even put more police in communities around the country, which we know what will happen.
Right.
When that occurs,
there's all, because look at the drug, the war on drugs, for example, phenomenon.
Exactly.
So you also have, I mean, if you want to ban assault rifles, for example, why not just ban them? I mean, for everybody. So you cannot manufacture them, and you reach a global treaty banning assault rifles, banning machine guns, banning, you know, all of these things that are capable of, you know, causing mass casualties, banning, by the way, nuclear weapons, napalm, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That is something that is consistent because, you know, by the way, not for nothing, if some kids or whatever, some deranged individuals are so focused on causing mass casualties that are now using assault rifles and now they're not accessible anymore, does that mean that they're not going to try to cause mass casualties, or are they going to go find something else? Like, if nothing else, let me make my own homemade nuclear weapon and bring it to high school, you know, or a chemical weapon or you know, TNT or whatever.
Right.
I mean, exactly. You're in a world full of weaponry. Stop making weapons.
Yeah. Well, we could do that under another social arrangement, but under this one, that opens up a whole can of worms that the national security state, military state apparatus in the United States cannot have, which is what makes this issue very interesting on the one hand, as much as it can be disappointing on the ideological and political front in the here and now. We know that this issue of quote-unquote gun violence is really a pressure cooker, because the more that you talk about things like assault rifles, the more and more you start treading towards the real root of all violence in the United States and around the world, led by the United States, which is the military state, the massive production of weapons for the profit.
As Martin Luther King put it, my own government.
Yeah, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and that has not changed. And that's the reason why these things happen. And if we look at the bios of some of these shooters, oftentimes they come from families of
military
state, intelligence apparatuses, or they've been investigated by the intelligence apparatus for years and nothing happens. So we know that it's the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. These massive shootings are really a product of an increasingly alienated and militarized society.
That's correct. Yep.
And they won't stop, because really the ruling class has no interest in stopping these things from happening, because
it's just more chaos on the ground. I mean, you know.
Exactly. And that's what also makes this so-called movement against gun violence so problematic, is that the very forces behind it, the billionaires, the military state, the police state, all of these forces are behind all of this violence. Meanwhile, you know, not to say the 50 or however many people die from mass shootings here in the United States is really a drop in the bucket compared to what happens around the world at the hands of the United States military, or the police here in the United States. But none of it is going to stop if the very forces behind it are the ones driving the movement.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, if you were a news producer at, say, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, whatever, you have the archive of, you know, military attacks by the United States, just say on Iraq alone, let alone Iraq, Libya, you know, all these places all over the world. How many, how much footage do you have of smoldering schools? You know, they got blown up. Mm-hmm. Like in Gaza. I mean, the Israelis blow up schools regularly because they say Hamas is hiding in the basement or whatever. You know, so I'm a news producer, and I want to explore the issue of violence. There's 168 hours a week of programming on my channel. There's news, there's Fox, there's this, you know, there's like seven or eight, you know, major producers of television news. So times 168 per week hours. Maybe I'm going to run like a 7-minute piece where I've got somebody talking about, you know, violence in the schools in the United States. So I start with a video of them on the podium, and then I start showing the video of schools that were obliterated by the U.S., the Israelis, the Saudis, etc., with U.S. weaponry. That hasn't happened at all. Okay, this thing has been going on now for, what, 2 months, 3 months, whatever. So let's say for 10 weeks, that's 1,680 hours. There hasn't been a minute like that on any of those seven or eight channels. That's not an accident.
It is not.
So it's not just what's missing, not just what's missing, but what's on is consciously chosen.
Exactly.
Purposeful. It's
consciously chosen. And what's usually on is Russia, Russia, Russia. Putin, Trump is an agent of Russia. Putin is stealing the elections. Putin is poisoning former FSB agents in the UK. There's always another story about why the Russian government, why Vladimir Putin needs to be taken out. But there's no stories at all. Unless Trump murmurs something that's completely unfathomable, like pulling out of Syria, unless something like that happens, or Trump starts getting bellicose with the DPRK, unless something like that happens where Trump is on the right side or on the wrong side, there really is no conversation about war. When there is, it's not a conversation we want to be having.
He's got them all baffled right now with his China, with his China stuff. He's got them baffled because... And with the backstory being Korea, you know, we may actually see a peace treaty in Korea that's 65 years overdue.
Exactly.
But as you know, they want war with Russia and China. You know, I mean, let me be more accurate. They want to control and loot Russia and China, and because Russia and China refuse, that means that they're looking towards war with Russia and China. Because just because Russia and China says no, doesn't mean they're going away. They're going after that stuff. So, well, and now suddenly Trump starts, you know, this stuff with tariffs with China, and China spits back, and the stock market dips, and they do this and that. And like on the one hand, they want to stab Trump because this is their impulse. I thought he said he made the stock market go up, and now he's making it go down, and it's going to cost consumers this and that. On the other hand, it's like, hey, but he's kicking Xi in the you-know-where. That's a good thing. They don't know how to handle it. I'm watching them sort of laughing.
Exactly. It's all indicative of the fact that the U.S. and its imperial system has completely lost control, not only of the narrative, but also of the ability to dominate at its whim without any questions asked. We have a situation where China and Russia are not going anywhere. And short of a nuclear war of annihilation, there really is no stopping the march of China on the economic front. There's no stopping Russia's growth economically and militarily. We know that now that Russia has weapons capable of truly defending itself from such a war, that there is a real panic on the part of the U.S. ruling class, especially on the military side, that this march toward a multipolar world, this new world arrangement where U.S. hegemony is not the determining factor of development economically, politically, culturally, and militarily, that's all very concerning. And Trump in office only makes it harder because he really has no stake in any of this as an individual, right. And that's always been the case. And that's always what has concerned them, is that Trump is for him, he's for his career, he's for what makes him look best at any given moment. And we know that in the realm of politics, that changes from minute to minute. For sure. And so that's why we have this inconsistency. We have Trump sometimes being bellicose towards Russia and the DPRK, and then pulling out things that you would never think would happen, such as a conversation with the DPRK, because on the one hand, Trump is a bellicose, kind of rabidly bigoted billionaire. But on the other hand, we have a world situation that he is not in control of. The DPRK and Korea as a whole have made huge steps towards peace. China has been a big part of that. Russia has made huge steps towards becoming an independent power in the world again. And those things Trump has no say in, other than how he responds at any given moment.
Well, right, exactly. I mean, then the question is basically, I mean, the conditions exist now where, because it's Trump that's sitting in the Oval Office, he actually has the political ability to allow what's happening with Korea to unfold that way without having to. In other words, if the two presidents of Korea and, say, Xi and Abe have a meeting and a public declaration of unification, like they have a 1989 Berlin moment, Trump can actually say, this is good, and we will pull our troops back, or whatever arrangement they make, actually allow it to happen. A lot of others, this is like a Nixon goes to China moment in terms of that. He's got the quote-unquote credentials to allow this to happen. That's kind of part of the story that's going on there too. He did a lot of chest thumping. He was calling the North Korean leader Rocket Man and the little guy. I was waiting for the little hands thing again and all this stuff.
We'll obliterate you.
Okay, he was saying stuff that people were saying. Say what? And so he's got the creds to turn around and say, this is good for the United States. I've looked this through. Letting Korea develop, blah, blah, blah. You no longer have a maniac communist group in the North, but now it's all capitalist, and they're out to make money, and we're going to make money with them.
Yeah, and we know that every president of the United States, in order to stay relevant to the ruling class, needs a foreign policy trademark. They need something to make a legacy.
Right.
And that's, there's people all over Trump's ear saying,
right,
this is what presidents do. They have foreign policy. They have foreign policy moves that really reflect their legacy. Obama had his with the so-called Iran deal. And, that was just after Hillary Clinton said that, they wanted to obliterate Iran. So these things kind of go in cycles. And it's interesting that when it happens with Trump, there is all of this cacophony and raucous, not for the cause of peace, but to ensure that regardless of what Trump does, that the war machine continues on. And I think that is a general trend in the United States politically, is that until resistance really takes an independent character, is really rooted in the rebellion and the uprisings happening politically in working class, poor communities, we will continue to see the ruling class attempt to resist Trump on the basis of ensuring that he maintains a stance on things like war, economic policy, all that that is palatable to them, and things like gun violence, the March for Our Lives, will merely reflect that in the final analysis. And we have to be ready to challenge that
and parse it.
And parse it, because these are issues they say are life and death. In the March for Our Lives, that's what they kept on saying.
Right.
But in reality, class war is not only life and death of a few hundred people here and there. It's life and death for an entire class of people, one that is built now billions in numbers, which is the working class, the proletariat.
Right. That's right, absolutely. And we're going to stop there. Dan, thank you very much.
All right, take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.